Today's Taisho is on case 11 in the Mumon Khan. Case 11 is called Joshu Sees the Hermits. Joshu went to a hermit's cottage and asked, "Is the master in? Is the master in?" The hermit raised his fist. Joshu said, "The water is too shallow to anchor here." And he went away. Coming to another hermit's cottage, he asked again, "Is the master in? Is the master in?" This hermit too raised his fist. Joshu said, "Free to give, free to take, free to kill, free to save. You understand it." And then he made a bow. Mumon's comment. Both hermits raised their fists. Why was one accepted and the other rejected? Tell me, what is the difficulty here? If you can give a turning word to clarify this problem, you will realize that Joshu's tongue has no bone in it, now helping others wake up, now knocking them down with perfect freedom. However, I must remind you, the two hermits could also see through Joshu. If you say there is anything to choose between the two hermits, you have no eye of realization. If you say there is no choice between the two, you also don't have an eye of realization. Mumon's verse, "The eye like a shooting star, the spirit like lightning, a death-dealing blade, a life-giving sword." That was pretty weird, huh? If you are not used to Zen tradition or Zen koans, Zen stories like the one I read can sound very weird, yes? You can say that. We'll talk about this koan. I'll talk about what's the point of koans and what's the point of these paradoxical stories. But let me first say, good job in first morning. How are you guys holding up? Okay. I myself, was so excited yesterday. I got myself tired by my excitement. I was so, I haven't asked Imtiaz, we don't talk, oh, yes, we are doing it, gathering the groceries, packing up, we've been packing for 2 days, and then by the time I lay down in bed yesterday, I was like, oh, I just did it again, I got myself tired on the night before retreat, just with my excitement, and then I had to do some more sitting to calm myself down. And then I got up this morning. I thought there was, I expected to be tired, but then there was just this new wave of energy. And then sitting outside was lovely, wasn't it? This is a very small group. There are traditions where I myself have experienced it. I did a retreat in a Goyanka center once, and there were probably 70 to 80 people. It's very different energy, and we are here like 7 or 8, right? 10 times. Each tradition has its brilliance, each style has its brilliance, and at the same time it can have its shadows. It's certainly true for Zen tradition. And I want to talk about some of the if you're coming from another tradition, or even if you're not coming from another tradition, I want to talk about shadows and brilliance of Zen tradition today. So you get to see how you want to relate with this tradition. When I just when we started walking today, the third option for walking meditation that came to my mind was something our dear friend David Loy once taught me, kissing the earth and getting this gentle, loving connection and kiss back. And as I was sitting, maybe my own practice is the reason that at this session I'm inspired to put grief work together with Zen sitting. As soon as I sat down, tears started rolling down my eyes. And I was like, where is my handkerchief? And the reason, at first it was like, what happened? What just happened? This is beautiful, cool morning. I just had deep sits this morning. And then the voice that came up, I didn't make this up. The voice that came up, are you ready, really ready, really, really ready to kiss all parts of the earth? Like the one that have been defiled, the one where there is blood of our indigenous brothers and sisters and black brothers and sisters. And are you really, really ready? Like, are you ready just to kiss this beautiful land, or are you really ready to kiss everything? Does that make sense? I was like, this is the challenge. This is the challenge. I wear these Zen robes. I am ordained. I can explain it to you if you are curious. But I'm not attached. I don't feel attached to Zen tradition. The question that boggles me, that is like another version of what I just told you. Am I really ready to kiss all parts of the earth with all its beings? Right? That is the central question for humanity. With all its wounds. And the honest answer is, I'm not, but I want to get there. The other way I could frame it, and this is what I wrote in our break period, our challenge is how to be open-hearted and whole-hearted when there are so many wounds. Okay? Forget Zen, forget koans, and forget even the whole earth and other people. Just in our own lives, we just have a lot of trauma. Yeah, you've probably heard me say this before, but this is the reality. I was reading a book on trauma, and I promise this will get lighthearted when we get to koans. So, but I'm trying to set the stage for our next 5 days. 1 in 5 kids in America was sexually molested. Okay? 1 in 5. 1 in 4 was beaten up to the extent that they have marks on their bodies. Okay? I don't know all of you very well. I know some of you well. But I know this experience is not uncommon. 1/3 couples, families have domestic violence. 1/4 have alcoholic relatives. You have one alcoholic relative and it starts a chain of trauma because your family is busy managing that. because with alcoholism or any kind of substance abuse can come verbal abuse, emotional abuse, stealing can be there. It just, the whole family is tormented. I have others, but I don't have to read it. My point is, we are either traumatized ourselves, and or at least we are dealing with friends and colleagues and comrades who have been traumatized. Okay? So now my question again, our challenge is how to be open-hearted and wholehearted when there are so many wounds, so much trauma. For the longest time as a climate scientist, I used to wonder, why can't people hear the truth? I mean, why is there so much denial? And then, you know, just in the last year, I've started doing so much reading on trauma and neurobiology. It's like, of course, no wonder. If the minds are so agitated, so trying to deal with our own internal stories, is there any space to hold grief for of others? Right? How can I care what happens to my neighbor next door when I am carrying trauma of my grandfather who fought in World War I? He didn't. I'm just giving a hypothetical example. So this notion that can I be ever ready to kiss all parts of the earth, all beings, all wounded vanishing beings, it's a tall order, but if we didn't try, we wouldn't be meeting our highest human potential. So what the neurobiology, the neuroscience that I've gotten so interested in last few months, you know, if you touched a reptile, you know where this is going if you have heard those phrases before. You touch a reptile, it can do two or three things. The first thing reptile could do is they freeze. They freeze, and it's sometimes cats do it too, just because they think they are hidden. It's like, you know, they think we don't see them either. So it's like hiding, freezing, denial. That's actually the most primitive response, right, in neurobiology categories. And then you make the brains a little bigger. I mean, even flowers or plants do it. There are leaves that, I'm sure you've heard, right? Touch me nots, and there are plants where you touch them and they just shrink, freeze, dissociate, denial. And then you make our brains a little bigger by the time you get a mammalian brain instead of a reptilian brain. We got the tendencies to fight and flight, right? Flee the situation. I don't want to deal with it. Avoidance. Or aggression. Okay. And then mammalian brains also got another category, which is, you know, it just amazes me. Female mammals do it way more often than male mammals. They do what is called tend and befriend. So even if a lioness's cub is getting attacked and she's worried about the cub, there is a part of her which is worried, and she could get she has potential to get into an aggressive behavior with whosoever is attacking her cub. Lionesses, elephants, and a lot of other wild beings, women get together. They put their kids in the center, and there is this kind of community formation that happens in the midst of crisis. Different from fight and flight and different from freeze. My sense, and I haven't discussed this with anyone, and it changes every week I do more reading and sitting and thinking about this, is that the place where we are as a civilization on this planet, we have all of these historical wounds that I just counted, right? Just the abuse within the family, alcoholism, domestic violence, and what I didn't count is the kind of trauma that a Jewish family might have from having gone through Holocaust, or what our Black brothers and sisters might have still go through because of the way supremacy of European cultures works in this country, right? 300 years of slavery and so on. And then on top of this personal trauma and cultural race-based trauma, the place where our civilization is today, it is really climate trauma. We human beings are really, really putting our own lives in danger by bringing Earth's ecosystem to a point where all climate scientists I know really, really anxious. I know of climate scientists who get panic attacks at night because it's like, what's the point of studying what we study if no one is hearing us? Okay? Everyone want to take a deep breath? All sad, hard stuff? And any tradition, anything we do in our contemplative traditions today, which does not help us address this, these two things. One, that we are so wounded on an individual societal level that we can't even face the truth. And the second, that we have this glaring truth that our planetary ship, you know, spaceship or whatever you call it is in crisis. What is the tradition doing? And so at this point, I want to talk about what could Zen tradition offer potentially, and why am I personally here? You know, there was one point I would say, why am I sitting sesshin after sesshin? Imtiaz was referring to it yesterday. Between him, between the two of us, we've done over 100 sesshins, 100 Zen retreats, like 5 a year. For 8, 9, 10 years, this was my life. Even though I was a climate scientist, I would do my science work, and then that was like, you know, 8 to 6 or whatever you call it, however long my experiments were. And then I was like this totally devoted Zen practitioner. No, not too concerned about family, not balancing what my mother might need, or so no activism, no thinking about that, just those. But now, putting those two things together, what we know, what I've know about science, what I know about science, and what the Zen tradition has to offer, if they don't talk to each other, it's like I'm living in split personality. So coming back to, we can't freeze in this situation. We are already frozen as a civilization. You know all those traumas, the personal level traumas? They make us frozen. And what we do is that we become that frozen reptile, and then our society has taught us to put lipstick on it. And then we go on. Does that make sense? Right? It's like distract ourselves. We are frozen in our heart minds. And yet somehow we keep going. The train is leaving, run, run. I used to work in Manhattan. It's just nuts, right? Everyone is on steroids. So there, it's not just lipstick. It's take steroid pill and then lipstick and then run. So we can't respond, and we can't freeze. Fighting, fleeing doesn't help. Fighting without any sense of rootedness, facing the entire truth, strategizing, forming the community, that doesn't work either. Okay, so now we're left with friend and friend and befriend, right? The female. Tend and befriend. I'm sorry. Yeah, that was the phrase. Tend and befriend. So you tend the young and befriend your fellow feminine energies. That certainly is neurobiologically, that's the best option we got. I want to propose, and this just came to me as I was walking down our walking meditation, coming back to the lodge. I mean, tend and befriend is certainly neurobiologically our best option. And all our healing traditions, our grief traditions, our meditation can certainly take us there. But maybe the challenge of our times is to go even beyond that. Tend and befriend and get hold of mystery and act from there. Get hold of mystery and act from there. What do I mean? Tend and befriend is the best option between freezing, fight and flight and so on, right? However, in some cases that tend and befriend becomes flocking. You know, folks, we say folks on the right, they have very tight-knit communities, they have very strong sense of, this is the authority figure saying, very loyal, follow the line, everyone will stand straight, right? Tend and befriend can tend to become compartmentalized too. It's like, it's almost like saying, I can go kiss this beautiful earth. And this is my village. This is what I will tend and befriend. So now when the challenge is, am I ready to kiss all parts of the earth? Then I have to go even deeper. Or at least try to. And this is where many contemplative traditions, this is not Zen's prerogative in any way. Traditions that help us root ourselves into something beyond our brains. So it's like go beyond even neurobiology. If we are going to stay with our ego, if we are going to stay as Kriti and Imtiaz and Aiden and Thomas and Rosie and Sanchin, tend and befriend is our best option. At least let's try to stay there. And grieving is an essential part of that, creating that community. Two blind spots of tend and befriend. One, I said, it can become compartmentalized in itself, especially in privileged white communities. It's like, yes, I'm going to kiss the good parts of the earth. The second one, I forgot. Oh gosh, it will come to me. I really forgot. Um, It will probably flow. How did it get lost?
Folded in history.
Yeah, I was talking about two aspects of tend and befriend, which are limiting. One is compartmentalizing, not kissing all parts of the earth. There was something else before I wanted to get to mystery, but let's talk about mystery. I mean, in some ways, tend and befriend is still locked in our either individual egos or collective ego. We need something deeper and bigger than our minds. Scientists have predicted so much. You know, we have different pathways about what could happen in 5 years, 2, 10 years. But everyone likes to say, who is associated with any kind of contemplative tradition, yes, we've made these predictions, and the actual truth is still a mystery, right? Anything can happen. We can change shift things. If we have to muster a response that is bigger and wider than anything we've tried before, because the crisis is unprecedented, right? Both in terms of the kinds of trauma we face and the kinds of responses that are needed, we need to tap into something bigger than our individual and collective egos. Does that make sense? I still am missing a very crucial thread, but we'll come to that. Oh, yes. When we do this tending and befriending and we use our grief work, the second downside of it is that we can just get stuck in grief. The purpose of grieving is to empty ourselves. But what happens when it's not grounded and rooted in mystery or something bigger than ourselves? People who go through grief circles again and again and again, they end up re-traumatizing themselves instead of feeling the release. I don't know how many of you have done grief work, but maybe you're familiar with psychotherapy. It's like you repeat the same story, you grieve it, and next time you come, you still need to grieve it. And third time you come, you still need to grieve it. And there is some truth to it. If there is an ongoing abuse, like the way planet is being abused, there is constant need to grieve. And at the same time, sometimes the grief is not releasing us. We just end up remembering the whole sequence of events, let's say, that happened to us 15 years ago, and we re-traumatize ourselves. Does that make sense? So this proposal that we have for our retreat, and it's like we are making our way by walking here. And we are not the first group that would be trying it. There are people who are trying to do grief work in combination with other things so that we don't stay stuck in that paradigm. Yeah? So now let's talk about the con, so we can hopefully try to tie these pieces together. And this will point to at least one or two of the crucial gifts that Zen tradition can potentially bring to the situation we are in. I don't know if it will. Zen has its deep shadows. This tradition has its deep shadows. Joshu is a famous Zen teacher. At another time, we could talk about his biography, but it was a famous Very famous, maybe most famous Zen teacher in Zen tradition, who actually came up with Mukhon. And he actually practiced maybe for 60, 70 years before he started teaching. Like he got his initial big experiences when he was still in his teens. He found his teacher Nansen, and then he studied with Nansen for 30, 40 years. Nansen died. They had a beautiful, beautiful friendship, as the legend goes. And then when Nansen died, people thought, oh, Joshu will start teaching. But Joshu instead said, oh, I'm not done. I'm going to go and study with other teachers. So he studied, he kept practicing on his own till he was 80. And then at 80 years of age, he started teaching. So he taught until he was, somewhere between 110 and 20. The records vary. So it was a really a wise mystic. We don't have to use the word Zen teacher, but you can, wise mystic is what comes to me right now. So he goes to another monk's cottage. Now the story begins. Okay. Joshu goes to a monk's cottage, or a Zen practitioner's cottage, another mystic's cottage, and says, "Are you in? Are you in?" And the hermit raises his fist. Monk raises his fist. That's part of the question, the paradox. How does the monk raise his fist? Okay. Then the Joshu goes, says, Joshu is not happy with the way this monk raised his fist. Joshu says, "The water is too shallow to anchor here. I can't stay here. No good. Nah." He just went away. Coming to another monk's cottage, another mystic's cottage, Joshu asked again, "Are you in? Is the master in?" Different translations use different phrases for this. Are you in? Is the master in? And this monk too raised his fist. And then Joshu said, "Free to give, free to take, free to kill, free to save." It's almost like saying, ah, this is delight. I'm so happy. And he makes a deep bow. You make a deep bow in Zen tradition when you're happy with an answer. And there are many different kinds of bows and shouts, but in this particular case, deep bow means very happy. Good job, you passed the test. Okay? So here is the, if you were working on this koan, right? You'd go into deep samadhi, you would focus on that space that comes at the end of your out-breath, you drop into mystery. Drop into mystery, and then you repeat this paradoxical koan in your mind. And there are key phrases that you could repeat. You could say, "Seize the hermits, seize the hermits." You're holding that curiosity, holding the curiosity without any notion of what is right or wrong. This is the crucial part. This is a gift of Zen tradition to the world, can be a good gift. Not knowing what the answer is and shutting down our thinking mind. Okay? Let's go over this one more time. So this story, it doesn't make sense from a logical point of view in some ways, right? At first, if you were working on this story, if you say one monk was passed by the famous teacher Joshu and one monk was failed, if you're just working on it at that initial level, the first response can always be, oh my God, I hope I am going to be the monk who wins. I don't want to be the loser. I want to be the one who impresses the teacher. Okay? Or you can go down the path if we are carrying that individual level trauma, right? When our fathers didn't care for us or our mothers didn't care for us, we just carrying all this self-absorption, self-consciousness, self-loathing in us. I am never going to be the one whom Joshua approves. Okay? So all koans can have that entanglement where they grab you at psycho-spiritual level. But once you kind of, I mean, the teacher shouldn't give a koan to anyone who will really get stuck in this way with any koan for a long time. We always get stuck a little bit. There's always this tendency, I'm going to figure it out just by thinking mind. But no. The gift of Zen is, you've thought this through, okay? Now get tired. Get tired. You can't figure it out with your thinking mind. Okay? Both monks raised their fist. Both did this. Or this. Or whatever. That was identical. And yet the monk, Joshu, passed one and failed one. Was happy with one and unhappy with one. This is, koans are paradoxes, paradoxical stories, right? If you are not used to Zen tradition, I say this all the time. One famous koan is, what is the sound of one hand clapping? Like, how does one hand clap? It's not this. The point of koans, the gift of Zen tradition, is bringing our thinking mind to a full stop so we can drop to something deeper. I'm not sure if it makes sense, but this is unless we have experienced it ourselves, this itself is a con. This statement itself is weird. What do you mean dropping into something bigger than ourselves? Right? And in some ways, this is not unique to Zen tradition. In Mahayana traditions, it's very common. It's not just that it's all anatta or it's all zero or empty. That's the first stage. When we work with the Mu koan, which is the first koan in Zen tradition, it's like fundamentally making ourselves zero. That's Mu koan. Fundamentally coming to zero. No vibrations, no sensations. That's a different understanding of reality. I know in Goenka tradition, I only did one retreat in Goenka tradition, so my understanding might be very shallow, but what I've heard Goenka say in his talks is that at the fundamental level, there are these very basic vibrations that make up everything. And in some ways, Zen tradition or Mahayana traditions would say, not even vibrations, zero. Come to that zero, right? My feeling about it is that they might be both true. It's almost like we say nature of reality, like physics would say, is it a photon or is it a particle or is it a wave? Does that make sense? Yeah, in physics. So there might be truth in both of them, but the Mahayana perspective, Zen perspective, certainly is come to the zero. Okay? That's your Mu koan. And you work on it, you're working on it. I know some people are working on it for several sessions, subconsciously working on it for many years. Your task is to become zero. Okay? And there is something deeper. You become that zero, and then And then there is something deeper, even deeper. Touching the mystery. Touching the mystery. And when I personally get close to that mystery, it's not like I'm certainly not always there. I'm a lot in this thinking mind. I'm a lot in my left brain, thinking brain. I'm aggressive. I want to avoid. And sometimes I'm intend and befriend. But when I touch the zero-ness and the mystery, it's like the energy that is sitting here in the form of Kriti is unblocked. Right? Even if it's for a little while, it's unblocked. It's not Kriti, ego of Kriti, making things up, speaking things. The voice is coming from something deeper than my thinking mind. Yeah? Small pockets, but I swear it's there. Because my frail, small Asian woman body doesn't have the kind of clarity and courage that I think sometimes exists, right? The bottled up fundamental energies, and that energy can kiss all parts of the earth. So that is, we can keep unpacking this, but I hope it makes some sense. It's not always true that when that energy is unblocked, when it's flowing, it will really kiss the earth. Our culture has a lot of blinders, and that unblocked energy can get stuck in comfortable spaces again, privileged spaces again. So we have to come back, you know. There is a lot more that needs to be done beyond just Zen training. Zen training in itself is not going to be enough, but it's a gift that can be used, that we so badly need, I feel. I know this is long, but I'm gonna, just because there are people here who are not used to Zen tradition, I'll talk about one more gift, unique gift of Zen tradition. There are so many things that if we got rid of, nothing would change, in my opinion. We could get rid of our sutra book and nothing, none of the words here are important. We could say ra 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 instead of any of the words here. It would still give our breath the same kind of exercise. It's about exercising our whole bodies and beings with that kind, different breathing rates, right? In Hindu tradition, they call it pranayama, when you go for yoga. So it's just working with our energy and breath in different ways. There is nothing special about these, right? The one thing which I feel is unique and is important that I wouldn't want to throw away even if we got rid of all the symbols of Zen tradition is breathing from our hara. Okay? So if you are here, I want to welcome you to try. Usually we breathe from up here, right? In Zen, we are inviting, I said this earlier today, I think in the morning, that you bring the breath down to your lower belly, 2 inches below your navel. Imagine there is a balloon there. And as you breathe in, instead of stopping here, you bring the breath here, and then at the out breath, I squeeze my belly in. It's not ab workout, but there is a slight tautness. Maintain that tautness there. And then next out breath, you fill up with air automatically, so you don't have to make effort. The classical instruction is don't put emphasis on your in-breath. In-breath brings in thoughts and emotions. Out-breath calms it. And it's, I from my understanding of how the polyvagal theory of neuroscience works, breathing from here is calming from the our neurological system. Really calming. A lot of trauma specialists are asking folks to breathe from their bellies. Okay? Zen has taken it a few steps further. I don't know how they did it, right? It was in 7th or 8th century when this came up, this whole thing about breathing from hara. So you fill up your balloon, which is around your navel, below your navel. You squeeze the air out. And then once you're empty, it's like you're hungry for air again. You breathe again, your belly fills up. And then you breathe out again. Each time you breathe out, if you can, you maintain a little bit of tautness there. And when you take the next out breath, you're making it even more tight, more. Do you know what I'm talking about? The tautness. It's like you don't want to break the spring, but you're the thread. But you're keeping it taut. And you keep coming back to that taut spring-like state of your lower belly. And in that place, you look. That can take us deeper. That's the pathway to become zero in Zen tradition. There are many paths to becoming zero. Sufi dancing is a path too. I haven't tried it, but it can absolutely work. But if you like, for me, this is a gift. Breathing from hara, it's really a gift. Some other day we'll talk more about this koan. There is a lot to it, but I'll just end with the Mumon's verse here. And another poem by a teacher. The eye like a shooting star, the spirit like lightning, a death-dealing blade, a life-giving sword. One teacher responded to this koan by saying, the spring breeze and a tree has two different faces, same breeze, same mystery, two faces. A southward branch looks warm, northward branch looks cool.
Shujo Muhe.